Welcome to a new episode of Wakan TV, where today we're going to be talking about our label Sasquan, the history leading up to it, why we decided to pull the trigger on starting yet another label. All right, awesome. All engines are go. So today we want to talk about the Sasquan record label.
Yeah.
That is our newer label, and try to dive into the reasons for starting it and what our visions and goals are for said label.
Yeah. I think a lot of people know, obviously, that we have Wakan, and Wakan is like predominantly bass music, party music. I mean, there's a lot of different genres that we've covered within those realms, but Sasquan is seemingly the flip side of that.
And interestingly enough, that wasn't really the case, or at least my thought process when pulling the trigger on starting Wakan. The interesting part is that I think, at least for myself, starting Wakan, I mean, it came when we've talked about this before, the reasons for starting it, you know, wanting to do more for the community, helping building artists, and also having a home for all this obscure multi-genre music. But interestingly, when we first started Wakan, both of us actually were very adamant that we did not want it to become another hard tear-out dubstep label.
Yeah.
So if you listen to the first Wakan releases, they're actually sort of similar to what we put out on Sasquan.
There's a lot of mid-tempo and
but I think
electronica.
When Wakan was started and in the time following that, well, I was, you know, producing all these different genres. We also found people who were onto something. And in the process, I don't want to say that, and maybe more like all these people together somehow created a new, fresh take on the sound, at least. I don't want to take big words in my mouth that we discovered or invented some genre, but we, for some reason or another, it became like a subset of bass music, freeform bass music.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really the thought in starting Wakan. It's just something that gradually happened.
Yeah.
And then let's not forget, you know, for the more danceable music that's maybe a little more formulaic, but more than anything else, it's hard hitting, and it's got the ramps and it's got the hard drops. It has a more established established platform and structure for shows and touring.
Yeah.
Whereas the down tempo, and this is probably something we're going to dig into way more during this episode, but the down-tempo music, maybe by it being more subtle and relaxing, it doesn't get as much attention.
Yeah.
At least not in America right now. I mean, I know because I would gladly go play shows with both, and I get booked way more for playing
music. I think, like, you know, anytime you have something like with Wakan, like when we started that label, at least from, you know, from where I was sitting, my vantage point, what I saw was trying out a lot of different genres, trying to just simply be a vessel for people to release music. And, you know, then you get into the finer nuances of, like, as a label, then you're required to say, okay, well, how can we make this as successful as we can? And I think because of that, we had in the early days a lot more success with releasing records and getting press and the marketing and driving traffic for giving artists a cause to tour from being able to release records. And then you know, I remember when we put out Babatunde with Peekaboo and G-Rex, I think I went to Lost Lands and I stopped counting it, how many times I heard it that weekend, at like 19 times. And so it served, releasing that served a function to be able to get our artists in spotlight and limelight.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think kind of as that label matured, we started getting notoriety for being able to release like underground cutting edge bass music. But I don't think when Wakan started, the whole goal was to be like, yeah, this is going to be dance floor music. It was, we just want to be mere vessels to help further artists' careers in this very broad genre. But then, you know, look, anytime you have something that has artists attached to it that are perceivingly doing well, you need to be able to wrap your head around it in an elevator pitch, if you will. Well, what does it sound like? It sounds like this. Oh, okay. That makes it so that a person can understand and wrap their head around what they're getting into. It sounds like this, 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 mixed up and put it in a blender. That's what it is. With what we do, it's a little more left of center, obviously, but it's still, there's those components to make people understand. And then as we progress, we're like, well, we don't want to just be that. We think, and as we started, we thought we could release anything from heavier bass stuff to trappier stuff to futury stuff to electronica to chill out, experimental, tonal sounds even. We thought we could just simply do it all, but we also realized that we had to be able to then on the flip side be able to market this thing that we were selling for these artists and helping them kind of grow towards. So we kind of had to almost in a roundabout way put it in a box so it made cohesive sense to a consumer.
For sure.
And that, I think, is where we definitively came up with this will be this, this will be this.
Well, there are a couple of more things to say about it because it's interesting because, yes, we started off like that. And I've always been sort of naive when it comes to these things. I want to do everything. I mean, I want the festival to be full of jam bands and ethnic music and not just, you know, I always try to think big like that. But one thing is for sure, when you start doing something, and like you said, we had a lot of success with like the sort of deep, gnarly freeform bass, very hard hitting, but clean production. Well, now when you start doing that, you're going to attract more people doing the same thing. So that's also one aspect that turns out that there are a lot of very, very talented people sitting here in the corners making this similar stuff or starting to make it. And so we got a lot of material.
Yeah.
Which in turn was the time when you actually approached me and said, hey, you're going to think this is crazy, but I think we should start. And that was actually your idea to start Sasquan. And that also had to do with that you are primarily responsible for the scheduling.
Yeah.
So we actually came up with a situation where we just simply didn't have more slots. And now you run into something where you're wanting the best for everyone and you're taking on too much. So now every artist has to wait for months and months to get catered to, and that creates resentment. And so despite our best effort, we even came into a slump where it's like, wow, we cannot even take care of all these people that want to work with us.
Yeah, and they were great artists and great records.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny that you say that because, like, now it's jogging my memory. I remember exactly, and I think I told you this, but I remember exactly, like, when it was, because I also used the reference. I had just talked to Josh Figure when he was touring with Crisley. And he signed to Skrillex's
the Oslo,
Oslo label. Oslo. And I asked him, I was like, dude, you signed so long ago. When's your record coming out? He's like, oh, next year. It's been a year and a half. And, you know, look, that's a huge entity or was a huge entity of its own. And it was simply because they had so much stuff chocked full of cool releases that
you get backlogged.
They get backlogged. Yeah. And that we were starting to have that happen. And I was starting to have these very long-winded conversations trying to explain to people why we couldn't receive a record and then put it out a month later.
Yep.
And they're like, hold on, how long? You're like, and you know, look, there's still even other labels I talked to today for some of my clients, and we'll be talking about releases. And it's like, Yeah, we're in March of next year, and it's just like, look, that's great, but at the same time, as an artist manager, which I am first and foremost, I mean, that's a very discouraging conversation to go back to your client and say, they want to do it, but we're going to put it out of March of next year. And they're like, we're in June, or, you know, whatever it is, you know? So that's, I mean, I think a lot of that came from needing to have more of like a decisive split to understand that ways that we can help service and vehicle, like be a better vehicle for some of these artists, where like if it fell into certain elements and categories, we did it on this label and then had a whole different schedule available to be able to kind of service some of these other sounding records.
And this might not be obvious for everyone who's listening, but as an artist to having a release come out a certain time of year and that coincide with your touring plans and maybe a little merch release, I mean, that's how we work, trying to maximize attention by pooling things. So not getting a release out in a proper timeline is very bad. It's very problematic. And then for us, you know, having the other hat on as a record label executive makes me feel really bad, you know, and sort of, again, you know, you have to explain to people over and over again why things take longer, and it's never a good feeling.
Yeah.
So eventually we were, you know, if we're going to be able to take on this amount of work and actually also release down tempo music, electronica, chill up, whatever you want to call it, we need this new set of wheels where we can pretty much double our release schedule.
Yeah.
And let's not forget too that even though I am, you know, highly involved in Wakan, I am not hands-on with those things. It's you and Chloe mostly that do the scheduling. So your work is still doubled, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know any people who work as hard as we do, and you and Chloe included, because that's such a puzzle to try to figure out.
It is. And it's definitely, I think I use this term a lot, but it's definitely a labor of love, but it comes from wanting to genuinely help. And I think that, like, you know, we're getting to a place where we're having to be a little bit more selective about what we sign and what we do and how frequent we put out stuff. I mean, like during the pandemic, we were putting out 2 to 3 records a week in between both labels. And now we've scaled back a lot. And just because, you know, like we have 3 tours out currently, we have a festival, a whole slew of merchandise that we're working on. We just don't have the availability to be able to take that much on, which has made it so that, you know, we have to, if we're going to do something and try to put our name on it, we try to make it as great as possible. And if you take on too much, things start to suffer.
Yeah, I mean, let's not, you know, you are also artist manager for Taboo and Champagne Drip, the two other tours that Wakan also sponsors, you know, but for you, that's so many pieces. I'm always impressed with that.
It's a juggling act, but
it's also about priorities.
Yeah, and it's very seasonal. Like when you're busy on a tour, well, it's also about trying to like make sure that not everybody else is super slammed, you know, like Lucid playing more one-off stuff, and then that's not competing necessarily from a time.
Oh, I didn't even think about, you know, that aspect, but that's also true. From a time perspective, sort of compete against each other.
Yeah, and look, everybody's on their own journey, and everybody has to follow the beat of their own drum, and that's incredibly important. You can't just be like, oh, well, this person's going out, so I'm not going to tour.
But you must think about, it's actually kind of something is like dawn on me. You must be thinking about that a lot. And do you ever feel like you're your own worst competitor sometimes?
Yeah, very much so. Like, and you know, that's the thing is like, that's why, like, and I say this on social media a lot, that I feel like, yes, a lot of my job is interfacing and acting and talking on the phone and emailing and meetings. But as I grow older, I mean, I just got back from Mexico and I was on vacation, and out of that week, I was actually out in the sand in the ocean for 2 out of the 5 days I was down there, because I was rolling out.
Sounds like you.
Your exactly. tour. I mean, my wife was not thrilled, but you know, and she gets it. But at the same time, like,
that's how you can go on 3 vacations.
Well, per year, well, it's not too, free, maybe. But yeah, you, I mean, and that, you know, like, but I guess to my point is that as I'm getting older, I'm also understanding that a big part of my job is thinking through and envisioning and planning in my head how to maximize the best time frame and opportunities for my clients. And that doesn't just come from emails, phone. Sometimes it takes, you know, days and weeks and months of just sitting, being still, and thinking through and formulating the best plan of attack to then go and do the work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think that there's, you know, there's something to envisioning how to get the best out of the process of the work. And, you know, that I think that that's the whole point of vacation, is being able to think through those things and just, you know, look into the ocean, or, you know, go into the forest and do hikes and whatever it is to turn your mind off of the normal status quo of how you normally work, to then allow yourself and feed that different side of the brain to envision how you would like to roll these ventures out.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And I think I'm inherently really bad at those things and taking vacations, but it is true. And for the music part, it also works the same way. Music is an emotional language. If you want to be able to write things that has meaning and a strong message, you better have something to say.
Yep.
Are you going to get something to say? You got to go out in the world and get life experiences.
Yeah. You know? And I, you know, like, as I grow older, I find myself leaning into that. But I posted on my social media the other day, it says, embrace the concept that rest, recovery, and reflection are essential parts of progress towards work and a happy life.
Yeah.
And I find that more and more to be so evident, that, like, yes, I can be this workhorse and be on the phone and be servicing my clients as best as I can and coming up with concepts and merchandise and press and all these different activations for them, which are all great things. But if we don't have the vision of knowing where we're going,
yeah,
then we can't go and do the actual implementation of these things to maximize the fruit of what it is.
No, absolutely. I feel personally attacked because I have realized that I think I love working and I work all the time.
I do too.
But I also think it's like driven a little bit by this, like, I feel guilty if I don't work. I think I've always been a little bit like that.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is there for a little bit, you know, it's a good reflection to me, where I was just thinking through that in my own head. It's like, yeah, I could actually go on vacation. Why don't I?
Well,
one of the things that actually keeps me is like,
from an artist's perspective, I think in my perspective too, like, where I have the saying of, like, what you kill is what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, what you put into it is what you get out of it.
Yep.
And for artists, there's this whole concept that probably the normal person doesn't understand, because they go to their job, they do their job. Sometimes they do it bad, sometimes they do it well. But then at the end of it, they punch the fuck out.
Yeah.
And they go home and they play Xbox or go to the bar or go fucking play Yahtzee.
Really ever punch out.
With an artist, it's tough to turn that off, because you're constantly like, I need to tweet. I need to see what's going on. I need to do a FaceTime. Yeah. I need to fucking post on stories. And then I got to be creative and write songs. But how in fuck's name am I supposed to write a song if I'm not inspired?
Yeah.
You know, like, and then as you're going through your social media, looking at these things that hopefully maybe you want to see your friends, maybe you want to be inspired, you then are like, well, this person's playing LA at the Palladium and they're doing this. And then there's this constant fear of like, well, maybe I should be doing that. And it's like, and the grass is greener, and that's a fucking head fuck.
Well, it is two things. On one end, it is never really any happiness at the end of the tunnel from comparing your yep. own life's path with other people.
Yep.
However, personally, I find it as a huge driving force because I am low-key pretty competitive. Not competing in terms of who's going to get the most money, but I compete with the quality of my own art. I compete against myself. I try to always do things better. So in a way, seeing other people do well to me is a huge motivator. Like, yeah. Oh, I didn't even know that was possible, but now I want that too. I'm Swedish. It's very well known that we have something called Swedish jealousy. And I am a very jealous person, but it's never really a harmful thing as long as you don't forget to do this introspection and realize, oh, this is a compass that's showing me what I want. And now I can go after that without being nasty to this person who happens to be more fortunate than I am.
To be fair, there's people like yourself. And then there's also people that, I mean, some of which I know really well that simply fall apart at the hem because they have this mindset that they should be given that. They should receive that for all the things that they've done, and they don't, and they become jaded and angry and bitter.
That's called entitlement, and it's never good.
You know, it looks... Some people can use it as a motivator, and some people can use it as the thing that is ultimately their downfall.
And I think it boils down to... I know we were supposed to talk about Sasquan, but this is very interesting. And I also have yet another question too about your management in terms of, you know, the competition. But just to finish this train of thought first, I think it's a matter of abundance thinking versus the scarcity mindset. From my life and what I've seen, there is enough for everyone to be happy and do well. And I rest very assuredly. I'm very sure about that. So yep. I'm not so worried about other people doing well. I just genuinely am not. I think it's awesome that people are crushing. And it's more motivating for me. But you're right. It's more of a mental... It's more a mindset. If you are of a scarcity mindset, do you think there is a limited amount of resources, there is a limited amount of music that people can enjoy, a limited amount of business ideas? But come on, like, if someone can, we can be so successful doing something as niche and weird that we're doing, that's, and being me, this weird guy with, this, you know, all my personality quirks and stuff.
Yeah.
I can do anything. I have to say, like, if I know I can do this successfully, come on, like.
Yeah, and look, there's people that can handle that, and then there's people that cannot. And I don't think that there's one that's right or wrong. I think it goes to the mentality of the person, of how they internalize that and what they do with it.
For sure. And that has to do with setting up. It has to do with being clear about what it is that I want to get out of it. It's that whole manifestation formula. It starts with focus. What do I want?
Yep.
And try to make that as specific as possible and quantifiable. You know, that's how you need to talk to God. You can't talk to God and it's like, I guess I want to be happy. But that's not specific enough, you know?
Yeah.
The more clear you can be, and even if you don't believe in God, it's how you talk to your higher self. Like, the more specific you are, the more specific results you're going to get. It's very logical.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you this about managing different clients, you know, now running two different labels, and you're very big part of these labels. I mean, you are the day-to-day person. You know more about what's going on than I do to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of the matrix person who tries to reach out and grab new visions for us to do, like starting this podcast, for example.
Yep.
But when it really comes to brass tacks, like, you're a very important person there, and you work very hard. So how can you make it so that instead of having your clients or your companies, or even your friends' companies, because we know so many people who run other record labels, how instead of competing with them and making things harder, how can you turn that around? So here, I have an asset here. I have all these racehorses or race cars. I have all this this amazing platform. There must be a way that you can turn sort of a weakness of doing too much into strength.
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
Well, first off, I think that that probably varies per person. Like, I know managers who never, ever will have more than three clients because they know themselves well enough to know what their threshold for work is.
Yeah, because you start spreading yourself really thin.
Absolutely.
And then it might even be like between the clients that they start getting jealous of each other. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. And that happens, and I've seen it time and time again. For all I know, it probably is in existence in my own roster. But, you know, look, like, I think that you have to be as respective to what you signed up for with that particular client. Like, when I'm working on Liquid Stranger stuff, it is solely for the intent of making Liquid Stranger as humanly big as possible. And then, you know, in a roundabout way, I have to take off that cap. And if I'm working on Lucid stuff, and Lucid stuff butts against Liquid Stranger stuff, I have to say, fuck Liquid Stranger.
Yeah.
And because that is the fine line of, like, what I signed up to Neil to be the betterment of his business wing for him. And, you know, luckily, like, it's not really like, fuck Liquid Stranger. You guys are friends, so you're actually really close. But you have to kind of go into it with those sort of parameters in mind that, like, whether it be my own client that we're fighting against or arguing with, or the opposition, whoever it might be, whether it be from our own camp, our own label, my own roster, which I've had happen where two of my clients get offers and they literally, you know, are by different agents and they're both competing and I'm supposed to make a decision. I've had that happen and it's super weird, but it's about being honest and being upfront with all parties involved and trying to do the best for everyone to reach that common denominator and make sure everybody can hopefully get a W out of it. And it's not, we're human. Like, we mess up all the time. I'm not saying by any means I'm perfect at that, because I'm most certainly not, but it's a very interesting dynamic to be able to kind of navigate. And it's not the easiest. And I think probably to most people, they don't probably realize that.
No, but a couple of what I'm hearing you say is, like, you need to have, first of, very good time management skills. And when you work on one client, you go in hard, regardless of how big that artist might be or how much money you take your time for that artist, regardless of where they're at.
Yeah.
And you're actually very good at that. And I know so, because I used to be your smallest client.
Yep.
And I think that what saved us in terms of, you were actually giving more attention because they had more things going for them, to your bigger clients when we first got started.
Yeah.
But you were also very clear with the communication. Hey, chill. It's going to be your time. And then I think having bigger clients and therefore having more connections and already existing infrastructure can actually help the smaller client.
Yep.
So as a smaller client, you got to just a little bit chill, be patient, and let things play out. At least that's what I did
I
with you, and it panned out good for
me. That's, and I think you're spot on with that, because I, you know, a lot of times what I find is that even though artists might be competing in quote unquote the same tier, they're on different cycles and different wavelengths. Where, you know, sometimes you're in a process of building so the bottom doesn't fall out from your brand. And so you're building this level of making sure that you have this proper platform. And that is the thing that you are progressing in. And in this scenario, yes, at one point you were my smallest client and we were building that foundation to make sure that when we put all these components together at the right time, it would create fireworks.
So when you have a lot to do, like I do as an artist at this point, you know, if I don't hear, and I hear from you a lot, but let's say that we didn't talk for a few days, I'd have plenty of stuff to do. But when you are newer to, I think just by the sheer nature of it, you're going to be more stressed and nervous and rent is due and I got to get this release out. And so how do you manage those things?
Yeah, it's, I mean, like I said, it's kind of like a constant juggling act for sure. And I mean, sometimes you're faster on things and sometimes you're slower on things, but every artist I know is in a different season of life and they're on a different cycle. Where Vail is not necessarily where Lucid is. Where Lucid is not necessarily where Mize is, and so forth. So it's like you're competing amongst these your peers, essentially. And they might get a show and the other person might not. And that's stressful and annoying. But it's also like setting it up to make it so that that's going to come in its time. And you know, my thing as a manager is like creating a lot of infrastructure to be able to prep the client. So maybe they're not going to play Electric Forest this year, but they'll be a dead ringer for next year or the following year.
And that's something I
because we've done those things to get to that place to put it on the radar of the buyer.
I find that very impressive, you know, being able to think several years ahead. And that's like a skill that you definitely have.
Yeah.
Which is also makes you perfect as the job as a
and it's something that executive. You know, I think you also acquire over time, just like anything. The more you do it, the more you invest in it, the more you start to learn about yourself and how to best engage and what needs to go pedal to the metal in that moment, and then when it's best to pump the brakes and be like, no, we need to set this up for the following. And you know, and I deal with that daily. Like show offers for one is like a very microcosm of like what that is. It's like, should we play this festival and be second on comparatively to should we wait and be fourth on or fifth on next year? Well, what is coming next year? And like I said earlier, like if you don't have that mindset and vision of like where you're going to be and take that time to think through that process of where you're going to be and what you're on cycle for, well, you might be holding out for something that doesn't exist. Or if you play it that year, you might be selling yourself short, because if you waited, you know, a year, you'd be eighth on and third to close.
So bringing this back to the Susquehanna record label, there came a time where you said, Martin, we need to do this.
Yeah.
And for us, just because we do get questions about this and why we decide to do things the way we do, and I always like to share those things if we think we're onto something good. I think you're very good at this, much better than I am myself. I think from what I understand, we started this mostly because of scheduling conflicts. Like we can just simply not take on more on the Wakan record label.
Right. In a perfect world, when we started, to put it at face value, we wanted everything to be under the umbrella of Wakan. As we progressed on that journey, had more people that wanted to release with us as opposed to not having those people that were interested, getting great submissions, getting great music in from people that we loved and respected, it became this natural feeling to be like, well, if we kind of split this down the middle and say heavier stuff over here, soft-ish stuff over here, or chill out, or funky or futury over here, whatever it is, that's a great way for us to be able to have more opportunity to be able to help. And it has to be within reason of what we can help with. Mm-hmm. But if we can, then that's how we should do it. And I don't think that that's anything different than maybe other record labels, like, you know, with Never Say Die, you had a Subsidia kind of label. With most major labels, there's like like imprints and things like that. I mean, even with like Disciple, there's like Black Label or whatever it's called. I forget. Roundtable was, I think, the other one that they had. And you start to see this more and more because you kind of want to either, it comes from a place of scheduling conflicts and not having enough space and not wanting to have records like be able to have this shine in this like window where you're focusing solely on that, or it comes from a place of like almost like setting this up in tiers and prestige of like, well, we want the big guys to release on this label, almost like it's your indie major label, as opposite as that mm-hmm. is. But we need to make sure that this has a certain amount of value, so we don't want to dilute it because we get in something cool, but yet this artist is essentially a regional artist. Mm-hmm. So some people set it up like that. For us, it wasn't like that. It didn't have anything to do with like a tier or ranking system. It simply had to do with the economics of having space to be able to fit it all in.
Yeah, that's one aspect of it. You know, that was one reason we did this. And the other, I could talk about this for a long time, because I think the other, like, first off, you know, you don't do things just because it's easy. For you, I think going into the downtempo music was kind of a new type of music, a little bit more for you than it was for me. I mean, yeah. You've actually learned a lot about the culture.
Yeah.
And overall, I have to say one thing, I'm really impressed with you. You know, since we got you, the really good speakers, how much better your ears have gotten. You know, that's literally something you can train. And I think that's amazing to know that you can get better at basically everything. Like, yeah. You have like trained musician ears now from listening to so many submissions. I'm serious.
I wouldn't go that far, but
be able to tell, and I am. So
it's funny though you say that, because I did talk to Cannibalist this morning, and I was like, we were talking about the song that she just submitted for Sasquan, and I was like, it's a really great song, but I was like, it's like, I wonder if the kick is maybe a few decibel too quiet. And she was like, huh, I'll go back and listen. And then after you say that, and I'm just like, well, that was the conversation I had like literally two hours ago.
And you do the same things with me now, and it's also very good feedback. That's the thing. So I guess what I was getting to hear is that it's not necessarily so that the starting this new label is just like natural, maybe so much for you. It's a little bit new. For me though, it's almost the opposite. It's like, this should have been the label that maybe got started first, just in terms of, this has always been the music closest to my heart. Left field electronica. I don't really like the term, but it's also been called IDM, intelligent dance music.
Dance music.
Electronica, down tempo, chill out, you know, ambient. Yeah. Also, you know, Sasquan, I think, was a place where we wanted to release more organic music. It could be more acoustic music.
Yeah.
But that's been the music that's been the bulk of my own productions, if you think about the Liquid Stranger discography. Well, and I'm not super, can't even remember, but I think...
I have it.
Like, if you think about it, I think like more of my released music is toward that reggae, down tempo, electronica, than the hard hitting stuff.
Yeah, when we first started, like, we just like put all those records out on Wakan because Sasquan hadn't been created. So for us, it was like almost like we had to like definitively decide, oh, this doesn't feel as natural anymore, kind of with what we're doing. And so labels, and I don't think maybe everybody always thinks this, but they also have kind of like, it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's like, I mean, that's a great example of sometimes just things that like we're kind of like along for just on the ride. That just has like kind of happened. We looked at it as though a spatial issue of needing to have more room to release and help. But after making that decision, it's kind of just taken on more of a meaning of its own organically, where it's like, well, this is what this is, and this is what this is.
Yes. I think, you know, one reason is the scheduling thing. The other reason for myself would also be that I'd love to be more a servant of that culture and try to help instigate a more vibrant live culture for that type of music.
Well, and we have a lot that we want to talk about and get through on our notes and bullet points of,
I'm sure,
Sisquan, but let's actually like pause on this and let's go back to first kind of in answering the question of Sisquan. We know kind of where it started and why. Explain Wakan, or not Wakan, we already know that, but like Sisquan, like where, I mean, because we talked about in an episode that like how hard it was to even come up with a name, Wakan. Then start this other label.
Yep.
And we're like, well, fuck, we got to call it something. Sisquan.
Yes, yeah, Sisquan is a weird name, right? It's always Wakan, really. And it comes from, first, it's my own personal experiences within, you know, my shamanic teacher and mentor that passed so much knowledge to me that I wanted to honor his lineage somehow. And so Wakan and Sisquan are both names that I learned from him, where Wakan, he interpreted it as the feminine essence of God or the great spirit, as they call it, Wakan Tanka. So Wakan is the first part. Yeah. Sisquan is the male essence of God. So the more action oriented. So I think it's a kind of a cool play on that. You know, and Wakan came first as the woman, you know, the label, and then Sisquan comes as the brotherly reflection. That's really where the names come from. And that just feels like something that, it feels like a good honoring to my mentor personally.
Yeah. So when...
But that's what the words mean.
Cool. And that... And I think we've touched on that before, but just so everybody has an understanding. So with that, when we made this like conscious decision to kind of split, almost if you will, into Wakan and then subsequently Sisquan, when that started, was there things that like you were like, okay, we now almost like have like a whole new palette to kind of create off of? Is there something like that you were wanting to like achieve specifically with the label now having like, okay, it's its own standalone thing? What were some of those things?
I think it's a good thing to talk about, because I think that's changed a little bit. And also reality comes knocking at the door. Like, I feel, again, that the down-tempo electronic culture is underrepresented in the live settings in America right now. That's where we live. So that's our primary base, probably all over the world, you know, in favor for the harder dubstep and traps and whatnot, you know, four on the floor music. So I think that the down-tempo music also stands for, you know, it's melodic, heart-opening music that I think could be very healthy for people, and also come together in that setting. I think could be a very healing experience for people. Less headbanging and bloody noses on rails and less hard drugs. And you know what I'm saying? It's just how I'm thinking of it. So I think it's got a little bit of a sanctuary culture. Then from there going into, okay, so it's very utilitarian music. This is music you could meditate to. So we have Light Code, aka Alice Dream, who've already put out a couple of projects like that on Sisquan. which is, you know, pure ambient music where you can listen to and go very deep within yourself. I mean, he's a masterful producer of it too. I listen to those records here at home a lot, waking up on the wrong side of bed or whatever, and just working with yourself to, okay, let's, what can I do? Meditate, do some pranayama, some breathing exercises, put on the right soundtrack to your life. It changes a lot. Think about a horror movie. You turn off the sound. It's not scary anymore. Think about how much a soundtrack does to any part of your life. And I feel like the downtempo music has a very, very big place there. It's utilitarian. It's music for yoga, music for meditation, music for, you know, I have problems sleeping and winding down at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so no jarbas after a certain time now.
Yeah, definitely.
But the other part of it is I'm just an anxious person. I overthink everything. And having on some relaxing music as opposed to like laying like obsessing over Twitter or some big ass action movie, I have to think about those things in my private life.
Yeah.
I have to program myself and be very conscientious with my surroundings, what I'm listening to, because that affects how I behave and feel as a person.
Right. Let me ask this, like, how do you interpret what we classify as Sasquan releasable music? Like, what does that, like, what sort of genre from here to here, what does that encompass?
So yeah, I've never been a huge fan of genres and trying to pigeonhole music. I also understand why, because that makes it easier to find it and it's good for journalists. And as an artist, it becomes kind of useless, you know, for a person like myself creating stuff. It doesn't really work like that to create music. It's more chaotic inspiration. It's a wild beast. You grab onto it. Oh, this is what came out, you know, at least for myself. I don't, I think just a wide description of the, because I don't even want to use like say ambient. That's sort of limited. It's very like soundscapey music without any drums. But I say something that's a little more organic and melodic, maybe a little deeper. And thinking about, again, going back to the utilitarian aspect, meaning that it's useful for something. It's like you pair that music with an activity in your life. There's not always you want to rage out to dubstep, you know what I'm saying? Or drum and bass or any of these things. I mean, I love going playing those shows and I love making that music, but you cannot always be on that gear.
Yeah.
You cannot just always.
I think a lot of people I know, you know, kind of classify Sasquan as like anything from organic feeling to acoustic to down tempo to electronica to chill out to
but it can ambient. Be psychedelic, even, you know, softer rock or indie pop stuff. I'm a huge fan of myself. I don't want to say that we just work within a certain genre as much as it's a certain aesthetic of the music, more organic, more melodic, laid back, easy on the ears.
Less drops.
Yeah, and even if there are, you know, because that's a production technique on how you can work with contrast in music. So that happens in all kinds of music, that you have ramping. It happens in classical music a lot, that you have ramping staccato, like big sections followed by softer sections, and it leads up to... So classical music from Beethoven has drops in a sense too. Yeah. We just call them different things. But more the aesthetic of it being able to be a soundtrack to a nice drive in Sedona, looking over the desert or meditating.
So when you're driving over Sedona, what artists kind of have inspired you to continue on this journey of making that kind of music?
I mean, this is really the music I feel that I started making myself. The very first music I made when I was just 7-8 years old, I was definitely inspired by early other acts that did, like Tangerine Dream is a huge inspiration of mine. Brian Eno, you know, who did a lot of work with David Bowie as a, you know, songwriter, and he was also a very good backing vocalist. But he, on the side, started really the ambient music culture, which was more soundscapes. It was more recording nature and putting some very etheric little pads on there or something. He's got an album called Music for Airports, for example. It's very worthwhile going back and listening through that if you're into that type of aesthetic. It's very abstract music, really no drums. It's very floaty and very psychedelic, but right. I listened to those things very early. And then, of course, you know, one of my absolute favorite artists is Aphex Twin, you know, and he's a very diverse artist, you know, from drillcore, super hard drum and bass and crazy shit to having released two wonderful albums, the Selected Ambient Works 1 and 2. I highly recommend people going checking out. All that came out on a label that I think also is probably like my favorite record label. It's called Warp Records, but also affiliate labels like Aphex Twin's label, Reflex Records, or Ninja Tune, Mo Wax. That's the music I grew up with. So it wasn't really artists who did just one thing. Like, again, Brian Eno, he did everything from music with Bowie to this kind of thing. And Aphex Twin was all over the place, but they had that side of them, right? Yeah. And that inspired me as a producer. Like, yeah, we're humans. We have different feelings. We have a lot of different things. Like, at night, I like this. At morning, I want to drink my coffee, but I don't drink it right before bed. I mean, we're all different. And so that music really inspired me. A lot of beautiful, lovely acts that came out on, like, Warped, for example, Plaid, who I think is one of the boards of Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, amazing music that's truly inspired me. You know, in my life, not just within like, oh, that gave me inspiration to write music, but just made me want to live as a human.
Yeah.
It's so dope, you know?
And I think a lot of these kind of acts have kind of like made it so that it has kind of like paved the way for
sure.
Kind of like what we're kind of doing now.
Oh yeah. We should definitely tip the hat to Warp Records, Reflex Records, Planet Mew. That's a music's label. Mike Pardina's, Mo Wax. I feel like I'm repeating myself here.
Yeah.
There are also like a lot of Mille Plateau is another label. I believe it's French. They released a lot of minimal techno, but also beautiful. That's been a culture. And I don't know if maybe Europe has been on the forefront of it. I'm European, so I don't even think about that. But I grew up with that in the 90s. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
That was really strong era for that type of music. Today, people should really look into the glitch scene in Japan and over in Asia. You know, it's been going for a long time, but also another amazing take on a very glitchy, noisy pops and clicks kind of approach to ambient and electronica.
Yeah. And now too, I think some of that is that, like, I guess the Americanized version of some of that would be, you know, your Spangles and
for sure. Even though Spangle is from Britain too, so
yeah. But like, I mean, I think he's far bigger.
But where is Odessa from?
My assistant Bree would know. Not a clue. I guess we could
is
call
there a huge act that actually has been able to do something really cool with music that still has a more soft, dreamy aesthetic. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it can actually, I have a huge respect for them and what they've been able to build. It's like really beautiful music, but it's not really in your face. It's like slapping you around, like forcing you to do stuff.
Well, I mean,
you know,
even your agent, you know, I don't know if most people would know this, but like you have two agents that book your shows.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is Cody and the other one is Jay.
Yeah.
Jay is like arguably the guy effectively in that world. He does Odessa, Jai Wolf, and, you know, all those kind of acts.
Yeah, so there are definitely, and, you know, another person.
He likes them.
Yeah.
And he also likes you.
But
so
another,
there's very much a parallel there.
Yeah. So you know, in that regard, we're riding on a very beautiful, already existing culture, you know, that's been going for many, many years. Another person, like contemporary, that I do want to bring up that I have a huge respect for, and I think that hard work pays off, is Closey.
Yeah.
because she hasn't compromised on her style. And yeah, she has a couple, there's a little oomph in her music, but it's also very melodic and ethno kind of world based music.
Yeah.
So there are definitely people in today's generation doing incredibly well. I think Elvis Dream might be tapping into that a little bit. You mm-hmm. know, he has that little side of it too.
Yeah. But there's like, it's funny because like to me, it's like for us, it's when we play shows like that, we always feel like those kind of shows have a very unique time and a place, at least for what we do. But then there's guys like Tipper who, you know, that's what he does. And he is arguably, I guess he would probably right now be the biggest in this like very more abstract mm-hmm. experimental.
But if you know Tipper, he's, you know, he's my age or maybe, okay, it's not important maybe, but he's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
And he used to do very experimental new school breaks. That did not used to be, I mean, it was pretty hard hitting music. He had a face when he was younger and out playing more shows where he was doing harder stuff. And then he's gone over more and more to doing this, you know, very organic electronica layered, you know, he's a very good producer and engineer, so like his music is very clean and big, you know.
It kind of feels like there's kind of like a bubbling and a kind of like a resurgence of this kind of being more inserted in modern day
mm-hmm.
music, which, you know, like even when we were talking about the small idea of like Sasquan, we were like, who, we don't even know like if anybody will want to hear these kind of records.
Yes.
And now, even in the past, 3 years, we've seen kind of it, you know, really start to blow from like Charles the First and doing that and Of the Trees and some of these other guys that have kind of like taken that Freddie mm-hmm. Todd and kind of run with this in their own lane. And, you know, and it's funny because it's like we look at that and it's like, you know, I'm sitting here looking at your catalog of down-tempo electronic stuff that you've done. And I would venture to say probably even in your own catalog, it's probably at this point 60%, maybe 65% more.
Have you thought of
that kind of genre than heavy music?
Yeah. Have you thought of maybe it's time to do a best of Liquid Stranger down tempo at some point, especially since some of those releases seem to, despite our best efforts, uploading them to Spotify, disappear from there.
We've uploaded the Arcane Terrain four times.
Yeah. And it just keeps...
And it keeps disappearing on Spotify for, I don't know, whatever reason. Strike. They tell me something different every time.
But a lot of my albums, I think that's a really good idea. Yeah, because I think like a lot of my albums, there are a few albums that are just like one thing. They're usually, because I'm just too scatterbrained as a producer, so I get bored fast. So I've done a soft song. No, I did a really hard song. Yeah. And I want to do a tango.
Yeah.
Song, you know, but to put like the best stuff in the same place, maybe with some remixes or something, I think we should start thinking about some type
of be cool.
legacy record like this, so we can find it in the same place and actually find it in the first place. I don't know what they're doing over there, but that's something that every day I get hit up by people wondering where are the records.
Well, in 2007, let's just go back and trace it. 2007, The Invisible Conquest. 2009, Intergalactic Slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
2010, Steel Trap.
Mm-hmm.
2011, The Arcane Terrain. 2014, Renegade Crusade. Now, I don't know if I would
qualify
this as like maybe like a down tempo or electronic, but like definitely electronica would be Anomaly, the collection, because that was that year that we put out like fucking. I don't know, I think like nine EPs in a row or some shit.
Yeah, and it's mainly, if it's not like down tempo, it's still more organic music, more influenced by island music, you know, Caribbean music, reggae, dance hall, that type of stuff, which is a huge influence.
Well, you know, even your, and I don't think probably many people know this because, you know, they want to Space Boss and Gunslinger and all these other songs, but like your arguably biggest song on the internet is Dissolve.
Yeah, and then under that, I think I won the most downloaded reggae song in 2011 with Bomba Clad Star, but yeah, that's not the most requested songs for... So that's an interesting thing, and I think that's exactly... And maybe we've been harping on this, I don't know, but my journey is very interesting because I consider myself probably being a little better at that and more at home doing the beautiful electronica stuff. But due to the fact that I also like being out playing shows and being active there, I make other stuff. That stuff has started resonating with people. I care because you do. So if you care more about that, I'll make more.
Yeah.
And that's how the Psychonauts and the Gunslinger, so I've written about, and it, don't get me wrong, it's fun, but it's just one side.
Well, and to be fair, all these records that I just listed, all of them are experimental, downtempo, whatever the fuck you want to call it. But then it was about Weird and Wonderful in 2018, 17, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that we kind of made a conscious effort to do, was to say, we have this over here and we have this over here.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to collectively kind of merge together. So that basically was... on from Weird and Wonderful,
mm-hmm,
forward, most of your records have been a collaborative thing that have a little bit of...
That was your idea, and a very, very good idea, because like on one end I had this very obscure left field electronica and this obnoxiously hard, just on the other side of the coin, kind of pubescent, obnoxious dubstep, you know, kind of silly. And to merge those two, and what would that sound like? And that's something I still live by somehow. Like, how can I make something that could still be playable? Like, my next down-tempo EP for Susquehanna, my first release on Susquehanna is called Unity, and it's right now in mastering. It's got 6 songs. All those songs are produced just like how I produce dance music, meaning the drums are in the front, smacking. Of course, the sounds of the drums are not super harsh, distorted, but it's danceable. It's got a big sub in it. So it's also those production techniques. It's not necessarily that you have to compromise on the type of music, but the way you make it.
Okay, so we've talked about Susquehanna quite a bit. I mean, we were on a journey. We deviated, talked about a lot of life shit. It was awesome. And so we need to be at a place to stop. We're going to come back with a part 2 and talk about a lot more Susquehanna stuff, talk about another record from Liquid Stranger, talk about a compilation, all in another episode regarding Susquehanna. See you next time.